Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Guy Branum is a stand-up comedian. You might have seen him on Chelsea Lately, At Midnight, and The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. He also hosts talk show The Game Show on True TV. And now Guy is an author. His book is called My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. The title comes from Greek mythology.
It's a not often told story from Greek mythology about Leto, the mother of Apollo and Artemis, forgetting that she was a goddess, then remembering, then sort of doing something, like being able to work a miracle to sort of get back at some people who she was pissed off at. I tell that story a lot to friends, to myself, because the version of it I read, there's this moment where the author wrote, and then she remembered she was a goddess. And for me, life has been sort of like a long series of events where I end up feeling kind of powerless or alone or not able to really do anything to fix my situation. And then I remembered that I was a goddess. And I couldn't necessarily fix my situation, but I could at least make some trouble.
Yeah.
You know, even if I wasn't making it rain or turning people into frogs, I was at least doing something to take some control of the world around me back.
Yeah, some agency. And as you say, as you write in your book, you say that was that sentence, then she remembered that she was a goddess, that was the most beautiful, wonderful sentence you'd ever read. And that story changed you. And you have this great passage about how this story changed you. Could you read it for us, please?
Sure. I'm not supposed to be a goddess. I'm very fat, I'm bald, I have a faggy voice. My family is poor, my parents are uneducated. I dress like a wet 3-year-old. My handwriting is bad, I sweat a lot. My parallel parking is amateurish. I'm wholly devoid of the skills required to make any ball go into any goal, hoop, or pocket. I'm not supposed to like myself, and I'm certainly not supposed to think that I should matter. The world has spent a lot of time telling me that, and in the past 30 years or so, I often listened, because we all listen. The world is mostly full of fine facts and good lessons, but some of the facts and lessons were built to keep you down. And I got kept down for decades. Then I remembered that I was a goddess. I may not always feel like it, but I have powers. I am an amazing dancer. I'm quite ridiculously smart. I'm strong, I'm funny, babies like me. I have very strong research skills. I make passingly good Punjabi okra. I have a law degree. I sparkle on panel shows. I'm very good at listening when I try. It's not amazing, it's not lightning bolts or control of the seas. I can't turn myself into a swan and have my way with whatever man I like, but it's enough for me. And Doris Gates gave me my most important power, the power to see myself. I can't control what people see when they look at me. Most people see a weird, fat, unsexy guy who is wearing cargo shorts even though he should know better. I can't decide if you think I'm beautiful, but I do get to decide if I'm going to feel beautiful. And from the moment I first tried it, I've been addicted.
That was great. Thank you. And so, that was like a really life-changing moment, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I was always kind of a bookish kid, and there have been so many, like, earth-shattering moments that happened in my life that was just me reading a book. And it's kind of hard to write a story about you being changed by art. This book is sort of like about the stories that happened to me, what happened in my life. Look, I made some terrible choices and made some real messes in my actual life. But it's also about sort of the works of art that pushed me into those terrible choices or taught me how to get out of them.
Yeah. As you say, you were a bookish child, and actually more than that, I would say, you describe yourself as having this insatiable intellectual curiosity. So I'm curious, would it be fair to say that your love of ideas and words were a kind of weapon that you could use while you were growing up, use as a kind of survival mechanism?
I think that they were more transportation. Like, I grew up in a very small farm town in rural Northern California. And it's very interesting because, like, I've lived in the Midwest, and I think that farm towns there are different because you have more of a sense of community and you have more of a sense of responsibility because the people of Wisconsin have to run Wisconsin. But when you're in a farm town in California, there's no responsibility. San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego are going to be running everything. There's no sense of community. There's, you know, I went to towns in Minnesota and Wisconsin that were tiny, but they had community theaters, they had bands. In Northern California, there was none of that stuff because everybody essentially showed up 6 weeks ago. And so in this place that was like deeply anti-intellectual, very working class, to me, it was just amazing that there was sort of like PBS and books and encyclopedias that could, like, show me other places.
Yeah, yeah. You say that gay men fear their own voices and fear other gay men's voices even more. Can you talk a bit about that? Explain what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, gay men mostly look like other men, so it is really our voices, both our physical voices, the sound of our voice, and the things that we say that identify us. And we're used to hiding. That is, for all of our closeted years, it is by hiding. It is by not saying the things that are true to us, by trying to not say them in the voices that are natural to us, that we manage to survive. Because we know that identifying ourselves will make us a target, will make us prey. And so we try to camouflage ourselves. And when you're doing that, having somebody else identify themselves as gay or sort of like present an interpretation of what gay means is very hard because like your own experience isn't being expressed. Having somebody express their version of your experience can be even more distasteful in its way.
Yeah. You have this great sentence in that passage in the book, quote, "You fear a voice you cannot control representing your life and your world, but because so much is unsaid, you also hunger for it to be said with grandeur, with plumage," end quote.
Yeah, it's really hard because it's completely true of me myself. Like, so frequently I will watch art about being gay or read a book about being gay, and I'll chafe at it in some way. I'll want to like distance myself and say, that's not me. Or, you know, when I'm on television, when I was on Chelsea Lately, there were always gay guys who were posting like, he should not be the gay guy on Chelsea Lately. He's not like me. He's fat. Or like, he's not like me. He sounds super gay. That's not what I'm like. Like, I can't blame those people for those reactions because when you don't see other gay people in media, the very infrequent times that it happened, it needs to mean so much to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You talk about watching an episode of the TV news magazine show 2020 back in the 1980s, and it was a very specific episode that made you very angry. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, they were teasing to a segment about America's obesity epidemic, and they were showing B-roll of fat people with their faces pixelated or their heads cut off. They were shot mostly shoulder to hip so that, you know, no one's face had to be associated with their gross fat body. And I remember being very disturbed by that. Like as a fat kid, and my head was attached to my body all day long, it was sort of implying that it was so embarrassing or dehumanizing to have your head be identified with your fat body that the show wasn't willing to do that. And, you know, I sort of use that as a jumping off point to talk about my relationship to my body, but also the ways that media represents fat people as not really having a personality or ever being good at anything.
Yeah. So talk a bit more about that, if you will, about the kind of message that the media and popular culture have sent to you about being an overweight person.
We see fat people as dumb. We see fat people not as protagonists, but people who are in the way of other more dynamic people who are getting stuff done. And history tells you a very different story. History tells you about scads of fat people who have done lots of amazing things. But we don't really see that, particularly in like movies or TV. It's always just that fat burping guy who's at best funny and at worst in the way.
Yeah, so how were you able to overcome popular cultures and the media's dehumanizing portrayal of fat people?
Oh, I haven't. I'm still bound up in it, in a constant state of struggle with myself. But I think remembering that that's the case, that this doesn't have to be a battle, mm-hmm. is important to me. So much of what we are told about fat people is that they can only be virtuous by fighting with all of their being to unfat themselves. And I'm not saying that anyone should be unhealthy. I'm not saying that anyone shouldn't manage their health. What I'm saying is that my singular purpose is never going to be destroying my fat body because it's got to do things for me along the way. I wrote a book. I have other things going on. And behaving as though it must be the only characteristic in one's life and be fought against with the entirety of one's being to be a virtuous fat person is hard because it means anyone who is fat has to either be telling you the story of their fight or not be fat anymore. Because even if they are telling you the story of their fight, you're still not going to believe it because they're still fat.
Is there one particular stand-up comedy special that you can point to and say, this is the thing that really inspired me to pursue a career in stand-up comedy?
I started watching stand-up during the stand-up boom of the 1980s when I was relatively young. And I remember watching Eddie Murphy's Delirious and just falling in love with his sense of power and agency and swagger. What I did not remember is that the first 5 minutes or so of Eddie Murphy Delirious is him just talking about how disgusting gay people are. And it was a fascinating moment to realize this thing that really did make me fall in love with stand-up, and in many ways defined the style of stand-up that I do today, also was full of homophobic messages that really informed my understanding of myself as a gay man. And it was a really hard process to try to reconcile those two things, to say this piece of art was very valuable to me and very damaging to me at the same time. But Eddie Murphy in a leather suit strutting around that stage and recontextualizing the world made me fall in love with stand-up, and I can never deny that.
Yeah. Have you been able to come to terms with it?
I think when you are a member of a marginalized group, you are used to deeply loving artists and performers and writers who don't want you. Mm. It is an interesting kind of cognitive dissonance because I think it does, in the long run, let you tell yourself a story about the reasons you don't matter.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, how many women deeply love work by deeply misogynistic artists? How many people of color love works by people from history who wouldn't have considered them to be a person? And figuring out how to reconcile those things, I mean, God knows I don't have the answer, but I think it's an interesting challenge because those things can't be denied.
Yeah. Yeah, very well said. Yeah. What is the most important thing you learned from Eddie Murphy? Can you point to one thing?
The most important thing I learned from Eddie Murphy was that when you're on stage, you've got answers. They may not always be the right answers, but you've got answers. You've got a worldview. I think one of the things that was appealing about him was at a time when we didn't have a huge number of iconic Black stand-up comedians. We had a couple. But, like, he understood that talking about his background could be alienating. So he needed to be doing all of the work of making certain that you were along for the ride, that you understood that, like, his world was what was important to you. And the most amazing thing about Eddie Murphy's Delirious, the other thing I didn't remember is it's like half biographical stuff and half pop culture stuff. And I hadn't thought about that at all because I only think about the biographical stuff, which really takes you into this experience of growing up in poverty in a large family, in a Black family. But that pop culture stuff is there to remind you that he is not unlike the audience.
Yeah.
And I realize the way that I do that myself.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a common denominator for all of us, so it's a kind of a bonding, a way to bond with your audience.
But yeah.
Yeah, at the same time, though, yeah, what you learned, it sounds like you're saying that you learned, the most important thing you learned from Eddie Murphy is the power of your own perspective, right? This idea that you have, each comedian, each person has their own identity, their own life story, and so that's a way of creating what the advertising guy, Ross Reeves, called your USP, your unique selling proposition is, you know, you yourself have your own story.
Yeah. My friend Emily Heller, who's a great stand-up comedian, she once said, like, stand-up was the only truly diverse art form she'd ever participated in. And I'd never thought about it that way, but when someone is on stage, it's all them.
Yes.
It's all them.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about having more voices in stand-up these days, is that it does allow for this diversity and really conversation between voices.
I'm curious to know what you think of Scott Thompson's famous gay character, Buddy Cole, who's having a bit of a resurgence these days. Are you a fan?
Of course I'm a fan of Buddy Cole.
Yeah.
Like, at my, in, you know, my little house in Northern California, there was nothing that was at all telling me about real gay life. And then, you know, you had Buddy Cole on a bar stool telling the most, like, jaded and complex and sophisticated story. It was always so funny but, like, told, like, an afterthought. Buddy Cole is amazing, and I'm so glad that Scott is doing him some more. I saw him at a show in San Francisco, and he was doing Buddy Cole monologues, like, about stuff that has happened since Kids in the Hall went off the air, and it was just thrilling and delightful to have, like, Buddy's voice back in the world, giving his perspective on things.
Yeah.
Because the wonderful thing about Buddy Cole is Buddy Cole was, you know, during a period of time when gay activists were having to ask for and fight for so much, Buddy Cole didn't need anything from you. He was fine. And I think that kind of, like, dignity and pride was something we didn't see a lot of.
In November 2017, you wrote an essay for New York Magazine. This was in the wake of a New York Times article in which five women discussed the sexual harassment and assault that they received from Louis C.K. Can you tell me a bit about what you said in your essay?
Basically, I was just saying that Louis' TV show, Louis, always started with him leaving the Comedy Cellar in New York, and so frequently showed him at the comics table at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And the comics table at the Comedy Cellar, like, the Comedy Cellar is a temple of stand-up comedy in America. And that comics table is so representative of the people who are at the top of our industry. But so frequently when it is represented in media, it is represented as being a place that is only straight men, or only straight men and a token woman. And I was essentially saying that as long as we have these deeply male heterosexual power structures within our business, it's going to be easy for people to do things like what Louis C.K. did. It's going to be, you know, it's also kind of, stand-up comedy is a really unstructured career. So it's not like there's an HR department who you could go to report discrimination or sexual harassment. It really is about us policing each other. And not policing, just sort of like looking out for each other. And having the people in charge be all straight guys means women, trans people, queer people, there's nobody looking out for us, or there aren't enough people looking out for us. And what I said in the piece was essentially, we need to stop behaving as those guys are the end-all and be-all of what stand-up is.
What do you want readers to take away from your book?
My book is fundamentally about my experience. I try to reflect on pop culture. I try to sort of reflect on the larger world. But it's mainly just about how I made it through life and became the flawed and wonderful person that I am. And I hope that when people get done with it, they look at their own lives a little bit differently, and they think about the struggles that they have had as powers as much as struggles.
Guy Branum is a stand-up comedian and the author of My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. You can find out more about Guy at wpr.org/beta.